Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 623, titled I Told You So Part 4, Looking Back on the Euro and the Dollar. This is being recorded on February 3rd of the year 2008. And once again, we're going to jump back to January of 1999. We're going to go back to January 3rd and January 10th of 1999. And in turn, you're going to hear an excerpt of a program recorded in early 1998, and we're going to reflect on the euro, its strength, the weakness of the U.S. economy, and the threat of the euro to replace the dollar as the reserve currency of choice. Here now is Side 2 of For the Record program number 126, recorded on January 10th of the year 1999.
Research credit on the following article goes to a member of the listening audience who gleaned this for us from the Financial Times of London, and this is from the weekend edition of January 9th and 10th of 1999. And this is a very important story, very weighty, so listen carefully to the analysis. This is a column entitled, Bubbles Will Burst. Subtitled, Even Optimists Say the Threats to the Global Economy Are Many, writes John Plender, last name P-L-E-N-D-E-R. The article reads as follows. When Noah faced a flood, he had the happy notion of building an ark. Many commentators fear that world stock markets may also be due for a deluge. Yet investors have been notably reluctant at the start of 1999 to build boats for a tide that looks increasingly deflationary. Even the more optimistic pundits concede that the list of threats to the global economy is usually long and impressive. Japan, the world's second largest economy, is in such dire straits that it will subtract from global growth this year while sending financial shockwaves across the exchanges. Brazil, the last line of defense in the emerging market crisis, is struggling. Continental Europe, where the Eurozone countries are currently running a $100 billion current accounts surplus, by the way, the United States has a deficit in that regard, cuts interest rates at a snail's pace and shares too little of the burden of the Asian crisis relative to the U.S. Note the last sentence, the risk of currency turmoil and trade friction looms large. As for the U.S., which holds the key to global growth, the fortunes of the real economy are unhealthily dependent on the markets. The further equities rise, the more readily consumers borrow and spend, which boosts the economy. But as they run down their savings, the deficit on the external account widens, raising questions about the willingness of the rest of the world to finance the resulting payments imbalance. If the market falls sharply, Americans might lose confidence and rebuild their savings. This would knock the stuffing out of huge U.S. demand and visit a huge shock on the global economy. If, by contrast, the market goes on rising and people continue to spend beyond their incomes, household and external indebtedness will become more obviously unsustainable. The market collapse would simply come a bit later. Why then, with U.S. equities already at peak levels, are investors in such a sanguine mood? The worst and most frequently articulated argument for equities is that monetary policy is benign. How can policy be benign when it helps expand a U.S. bubble that could destabilize the world economy when it bursts? This is manic short-termism. Moreover, to the extent that cuts in nominal interest rates are a response to deflationary pressure, they may do little to help the real economy. It is the level of real rates, after allowing for the change in price level, that matters. Note, too, that falling nominal rates did little for the Japanese market in the 1990s. The much better argument, advanced by Gavin Davies of Goldman Sachs, that last name is capital D-A-V-I-E-S, is that policymakers will respond sensibly to threats and that the world economy will muddle through. But this raises the question of what constitutes sound policy when U.S. equities continue to bubble. Alan Greenspan, chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve, does not believe in making asset prices an explicit target of monetary policy, nor in pricking bubbles. In effect, his policy is to hope for a gentle market correction in response to weakening earnings. Yet he does believe in preventing market collapses. Witness his cuts in interest rates since September. The snag is that by decreasing the return on cash relative to equities and persuading investors that the Fed has put a safety net under the market, he has ensured an even bigger bubble. This, inevitably, is less susceptible to gentle deflation. The U.S. may thus be in the early stages of replicating the deflationary disaster in Asia. This next couple of paragraphs sums up what the real dangers of the analysis presented there is, and I agree with that analysis, although it's not easy for a relative economic novice like myself to wade through that. But here are a couple of the real key paragraphs. The U.S. may thus be in the early stages of replicating the deflationary disaster in Asia, which is essentially a crisis of overinvestment. For it is not just the U.S. consumer who borrows and spends. Business investment in the U.S. is growing at its fastest for 15 years, partly because of a decline in the cost of capital brought about by the stock market bubble. As with Japan in the 1980s, this will distort investment in favor of inefficient projects. But portfolio investors have failed to observe that the low cost of capital means a low return on capital because the two numbers must equate. After the Asian miracle, it seems we have a U.S. miracle that will in due course leave an unholy hangover. Could there be a miraculous escape? Possibly, if recent interest rate cuts in the West give Asia the leeway to trade its way back to health. But events in the two largest Asian economies hardly point in that direction. The growth prospect in China appears to be deteriorating, and the capacity of Japanese policymakers to follow up is nonpareil. Successive Japanese fiscal packages are being offset not only by collapsing consumer spending, but by a reduction in business investment from its earlier absurd levels. The only question in 1999 is how far economic shrinkage can be stopped. Meantime, the authorities appear hell-bent on catastrophe. Their bizarre wish for a strong yen means that Japan is fighting a slump by tightening monetary policy. This also inflicts losses on Japanese overseas investors and curbs the yen carry trade, whereby people borrow in yen to buy dollar assets. These changes in the relationship between the yen and the dollar mean that the driving force behind the U.S. currency has shifted from the capital account to the current account. Nothing could be better designed to make the U.S. payments deficit harder to finance. At which point, enter the euro to provide new competition for the dollar. This last paragraph again. These changes in the relationship between the yen and the dollar mean that the driving force behind the U.S. currency has shifted from the capital account to the current account. Nothing could be better designed to make the U.S. payments deficit harder to finance. At which point, enter the euro to provide new competition for the dollar. In sum, U.S. policy relies on luck. Japanese policy is a disaster. European policy combines the sluggish with the experimental. And the trouble with deflation is that it responds less predictably to policy than inflation. Incremental change is rarely enough to restore business and consumer confidence against a background of falling prices. Note, too, that great market collapses often accompany changes in global currency relationships. This last couple of paragraphs are important. Note, too, that great market collapses often accompany changes in global currency relationships. The crash of 1929 and subsequent slump coincided with a difficult transition from sterling to dollar hegemony. Roger Bootle, Bootle, the economist who warned of deflation earlier than most, is urging clients to read J.K. Galbraith's The Great Crash. Improving literature for the times, though the precise timing of any crash is inherently unpredictable. The point is that bubbles, like negative savings ratios or disintegrating current accounts, cannot go on forever. And in the first half hour of this particular pair of half hour segments, we talked about the apparently glowing assessment of the speculation by monetary speculators between the euro and the dollar. And that combined with the U.S. Balance of payments deficit, not trade deficit, but balance of payments deficit, could prove devastating, according to people I know whose analysis I respect. This consideration is to be weighed against the historical outline of the European Monetary Union. Again, it is not the benign commercial vehicle that it is represented as being, in my opinion, but rather is an economic vehicle for German world conquest. And this might sound strange to some people, but something that has not been properly analyzed in the current political scene is the ongoing effects of pan-Germanism. And I think that the severe threat to the U.S. economy presented by the euro should be evaluated against the theories of Friedrich Liest. What we're going to do next is to listen to an excerpt of a half-hour segment recorded in early 1998 called The Coming of the European Monetary Union. It's important to understand that the European Monetary Union represents the concretization, the realization of a plan for German domination of not only Europe, but eventually the world, that was first formulated in the 1840s by a pan-German theoretician, economist, and propagandist named Friedrich von Liszt. His last name, capital V-O-N, capital L-I-S-T. Von Liszt's formula for a united Europe dominated by Germany as a vehicle for not only unhorsing Great Britain as the dominant colonial power in the world, remember that Liszt was talking in the 1840s, but ultimately as a vehicle for German domination, the von Liszt-ian formula for German world domination was described in a book entitled The Thousand Year Conspiracy, subtitled Secret Germany Behind the Mask. This book was authored by an expert on pan-Germanism entitled, named Paul Winkler, last name W-I-N-K-L-E-R, and his book was published in hardcover by Charles Scribner's and Sons, copyright 1943. Now again, this book is entitled The Thousand Year Conspiracy, Secret Germany Behind the Mask, authored by Paul Winkler, an expert on pan-Germanism, and Winkler began his book with a quote from Patrick Henry that was given at the speech at the Virginia Assembly in May of 1765, and Patrick Henry spoke saying, quote, "I know of no way of judging the future but by the past," unquote. And indeed, I think that it is important to study the past in order to understand the present and accurately anticipate the future. Paul Winkler, in The Thousand-Year Conspiracy, Secret Germany Behind the Mask, discussed Friedrich Liszt's formulas for, actually, not von Liszt, but Friedrich Liszt, capital L-I-S-T. Winkler describes Liszt's formula for German world domination in The Thousand-Year Conspiracy. Bear in mind that Friedrich Liszt wrote in the 1840s, and that this book was published in 1943, more than a half century ago. In a section of the book entitled Starvation as a Springboard, Winkler writes, Friedrich Liszt, along with several minor economists active around 1840, was responsible for formulating the principal theories on which present-day German economic conquest is based. After emigrating to Pennsylvania and becoming an American citizen, Liszt was concerned only with Germany's greatness. He returned to Germany in 1840 to publish there his principal work, in which he outlined the basis for his national system of political economy. Violently opposed to the principle of free trade because it gives the same advantages to weak as to strong nations, he would welcome its use without reservation within the continent of Europe once the continent were dominated by Berlin, and he had high hopes that this would be achieved as soon as possible. So far as his own age was concerned, however, he was an extreme protectionist and advocated development of new industry in Germany through high protective tariffs raised against competition of foreign countries. He took into full account the risk of losing Germany's foreign markets, since protectionism always provokes reprisals. His remedy is simple: stimulate tremendous expansion of Germany, including conquest of Europe, acquisition of colonies in Australia, New Zealand, India, and the Americas. Then, Germany would no longer have to fear that she might lack foreign markets in a protectionist world. According to Liszt, a nation must conquer all countries lying in its sphere of economic action, by degrees, but steadily. And the sphere of action, this sphere of action is defined as every territory which may serve as outlet or which contains raw materials the nation may need. In the long run, this becomes perpetual conquest, for virtually every foreign country, however distant, represents a potential export market or is a producer of useful raw materials. In the ideas of Liszt, we find the economic basis for General von Bernhardi's thesis, that's capital B-E-R-N-H-A-R-D-I, quote, "For us, there are two alternatives and no third, world dominion or ruin." And skipping down, more about Liszt's formulas for economic domination. Charles Andler, capital A-N-D-L-E-R, a French author, summed up certain ideas of Liszt in his work, The Origins of Pan-Germanism, published in 1915. "It is necessary to organize continental Europe against England. Napoleon I, a great strategist, also knew the methods of economic hegemony. His continental system, which met with opposition even from countries which might have profited from such an arrangement, should be revived, but this time, not as an instrument of Napoleonic domination. The idea of uniting Europe in a closed trade bloc is no longer shocking if Germany assumes domination over such a bloc
and not France. One more time, because that is exactly what the European Monetary Union is. It is the realization of the ideas and the theories of Liszt. Quote, "The idea of uniting Europe in a closed trade bloc is no longer shocking if Germany assumes domination over such a bloc and not France, Belgium, Holland, Switzerland, and not France. Excuse me. Belgium, Holland, Switzerland, willingly or by force, will enter this customs federation. Austria is assumed to be won over at the outset. Even France, if she gets rid of her notions of military conquest, will not be excluded. The first steps the Confederation would take to assure unity of thought and action would be to establish a joint representative body, as well as to organize a common fleet. But of course, both the headquarters of the Federation and its parliamentary seat would be in Germany." Well, the European Commission is in fact just such a parliament. The European Parliament is more a ceremonial body. And I would note that the European Monetary Institute is going to be in Frankfurt. Continuing, "At once the sharing of common commercial advantages would begin. Liszt proposes something like a cooperative league of nations in which all profits would be distributed in proportion to investments. European vitality, intelligence, and order would put the Far East to good use. Oriental ports would become free cities," unquote, "where European agents would deal with native authorities in the capacity of advisors duly accredited and diplomatically protected. Austria would extend its borders to the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf. A German navy would be built up, Prussian colonies would be established in Australia and New Zealand, where England has firmly planted her flag but failed to exploit resources. How could England resist all the navies and the concentrated economic power of a united Central Europe? Since Germany possesses a greater stock of vital energy and superior economic ability to that of any other nation," by the way, this, of course, in the opinion of Liszt, "one may guess which nation would be likely to benefit most from this association, an association which was to be based on the principle of equal privilege for all members," unquote. And by the way, I would note that not only is the coming European Monetary Union the realization of the theories proposed by Liszt, but the dominant power in the world now, of course, is not Great Britain, but is the United States. So I think from a practical geopolitical standpoint, one can replace England or Great Britain with the United States. It should be noted that as the Germans conquered the nations of Europe in World War II, their economic infrastructures were subordinated to those of Germany, which gave Germany a profound economic control over the rest of Europe, even after the formal end of hostilities. That is one of the factors that has propelled Germany to the dominant position it is in Europe, and I suspect eventually the world as well. This was described by Paul Winkler as follows in The Thousand-Year Conspiracy. Now, bear in mind, of course, he was writing during the course of World War II, and he was writing in 1943. Winkler writes, "Until the present, this operation has succeeded much more completely in a country like France, where local authorities have accepted the idea of collaboration, than in countries occupied against the resistance of their governments. In France, capture of control of corporations through forced sale to Germans took place with a show of legality because French authorities and courts, under pressure from Vichy, countenanced these transactions. The Prusso-Teutonics know that military occupation of France cannot last forever. Besides, they have probably considered the possibility of a German defeat, which would bring about the fall of the Nazi regime. They must have said to themselves that even in that case, conquest of France would have yielded them the key advantages they had hoped to gain. They figured that it would be extremely difficult for the French to find the legal forms to get rid of German control over nearly the whole of their national economy. This control having thus been established within legal framework, according to French law, the task of destroying it would be arduous and complicated. This would be true even for a government under no obligation to respect the agreements of Vichy. It would, of course, be more true for any French government recognizing Vichy laws and decrees. All of this entered into the preparation for what Hitler calls the new economic order. This new order is in its entirety the old Prussian scheme of Liszt, which 90 years before Hitler's reign provided the blueprint for the creation of European economic unity under domination of a Prussian Germany. One more time. This new order is in its entirety the old Prussian scheme of Liszt, which 90 years before Hitler's reign provided the blueprint for the creation of European economic unity under domination of a Prussian Germany. It also provided for subsequent expansion of this Prusso-Teutonic Europe through invasion of the markets of other continents and establishment of, quote, protectorates, unquote, throughout the world. This scheme had always been close to the hearts of the Prusso-Teutonic powers of Germany and had been placed by Dr. Schock and Dr. Funk in the foreground of the aims pursued by Hitler. By the way, Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schock was the first and most prominent of Hitler's finance ministers. Continuing, territorial conquest has a meaning subordinate to economic conquest, according to Liszt's formula. By the way, one of the tactics that was also advocated by the Pan-Germanists was the political and economic conquest of rival nations through the use of what the Nazis referred to as a fifth column. This basically is a group of allies to the power that would effect conquest and who are obviously, therefore, by definition, traitors to their own country. And the Germans utilized this economic fifth column tactic very effectively in bringing France to its knees. That is discussed at considerable length in a miscellaneous archive show, specifically the September 4th, 1994 installment of Why Johnny Can't Identify Il Duce, dealing with the 1938 coup attempt in France and the subversion of the French military and political infrastructures by domestic fascists in league with Germans prior to the Nazi invasion of and consequent lightning conquest of France. Paul Winkler wrote of the von Bülow tactic in The Thousand-Year Conspiracy, and wrote as follows. Dietrich von Bülow, B-U-E-L-O-W, of whom we have already spoken, and who died in 1807, had this to say in his Spirit of Modern Warfare. And then skipping down, von Bülow also clearly formulated the ideas underlying the penetration, now a sad reality, by the fifth column into democratic countries, including creation of, quote, economic allies, unquote, in enemy countries, in the persons of a few great industrialists to whom economic advantages are promised. This system gave Germany excellent results in the conquest of France, and before America's entry into the war, she tried to employ similar methods in the United States as well. In the writings of von Bülow are anticipated all the advantages which Germany's masters later gained in several countries by carrying on a campaign of corruption of the enemy at home. By the way, I would note that the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that I have spoken about in so many archive shows, including the Uncle Sam and the Swastika program dating to May of 1980, was one of the central factors in helping to bring fascism to Germany in the first place. Indeed, 70% of the investment capital that went to build up Nazi Germany came from the United States and Great Britain, most of it from the United States. And as we looked at in an interview with John Loftus, along with Mark Ahrens, the co-author of The Secret War Against the Jews, had Franklin Roosevelt lived, he was going to have many of the German industrialists and financiers who had backed Hitler and who were standing trial in Nuremberg name their American and British co-conspirators, and many of the most prominent names in American finance and industry would have been in the defendant stock at Nuremberg had Franklin Roosevelt lived. Because indeed, as I have noted in numerous archive shows, those American financiers and industrialists who were instrumental in bringing fascism to Germany and Italy, along with their Italian and German counterparts, those industrialists and financiers comprise many of the elite of American finance and industry, and their role in helping to, and their economic cooperation with the fascist powers of Europe was central not only for the successful prosecution of those countries' war aims, but indeed in the very bringing to power of fascism in Germany in the first place. That is a tall order for the uninitiated. I refer interested listeners to not only the aforementioned Uncle Sam and the Swastika, but the Uncle Sam and Il Duce program, as well as the first two RFA programs, and also RFA number 10, in which I discussed the 1934 coup attempt in which many of those same industrialists and financiers tried to overthrow Roosevelt and replace him with a fascist dictator set up along the lines of Mussolini.
That, again, excerpted from a half-hour segment called The Coming of the European Monetary Union, recorded in January, or in early 1998.
That again was side B of For the Record program number 126, recorded on January 10th of 1999. And in turn, you heard an excerpt of For the Record program number 85, recorded in early 1998, roughly 10 years ago. And what we're going to do now is to close the broadcast, namely For the Record program number 623, side B, with an excerpt of, in turn, one of the introduction to one of the books that's available for download for free on the Spitfire website, Germany Plots with the Kremlin by T.H. Tettens. And in turn, we're going to read journalist Dorothy Thompson's account written in the New York Herald Tribune of May 31st, 1940. And what Dorothy Thompson was writing about is what the Germans intended to do after they won the next World War. And bear in mind that World War II was less than a year old at this point. Dorothy Thompson, writing in the New York Herald Tribune of 5/31/1940, wrote, quote, "The Germans have a clear plan of what they intend to do in case of victory. I believe that I know the essential details of that plan. I've heard it from a sufficient number of important Germans to credit its authenticity. Germany's plan is to make a customs union of Europe with complete financial and economic control centered in Berlin. This will create at once the largest free trade area and the largest planned economy in the world. In Western Europe alone, there will be an economic unity of 400 million persons. To these will be added the resources of the British, French, Dutch, and Belgian empires. These will be pooled in the name of Europa Germanica," unquote. The Germans count upon political power following economic power and not vice versa. Territorial changes do not concern them because there will be no France or England, unquote, except as language groups. Little immediate concern is felt regarding political organizations. No nation will have the control of its own financial or economic system or of its customs. The Nazification of all countries will be accomplished by economic pressure. In all countries, contacts have been established long ago with sympathetic businessmen and industrialists. As far as the United States is concerned, the planners of the World Germanica laugh off the idea of any armed invasion. They say that it will be completely unnecessary to take military action against the United States to force it to play ball with this system. Here, as in every other country, they have established relations with numerous industries and commercial organizations to whom they will offer advantages in cooperation with Germany. And again, that Dorothy Thompson writing on May 31st of 1940 in the New York Herald Tribune. Whew! Aren't you glad that didn't happen? This concludes For the Record program number 623, side B. I Told You So, part 4, looking back on the euro and the dollar. This has been recorded on February 3rd of the year 2008. My name is Dave Emery. I Told You So.